Tonight is a major victory for democracy in Ohio. The majority still rules in Ohio.
What? You don't say. Well, for now, anyway. They'll fix it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. Hope you guys are okay. Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, they're okay. Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's, AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. I've got some very good news momentarily. You heard a reference there at the top of the show, but Desi Doyen, as we go to air late this afternoon, we are getting word out of the island of Maui, as noted, home to our affiliate KAKU, some very bad news, very disturbing news. Wildfires have been raging all day there on the, well,
the
several
west
parts,
side
but on,
of, yes.
Largely on the west side of the island, as well as on the Big Island. They have gotten much worse and now deadly, as AP reports late this afternoon. A wildfire tore through the heart of Maui on Wednesday with alarming speed and ferocity, destroying dozens of homes, businesses in the historic town of Lahaina, killing at least six people, injuring at least two dozen others, and forcing panicked residents to jump into the ocean to flee flames. Fire was widespread at, how do you say it?
Lahaina.
Lahaina town, a popular shopping and dining area. That, according to the county of Maui, photos posted overnight by the county showed flames blazing near the town's center that dates back to the 1700s and is on the National Register of Historic Places. Aerial video has since revealed entire blocks of buildings reduced to ash with thick smoke in the air. Crews on Maui were battling multiple blazes both in West Maui and an inland mountainous region. 911 service and cell phones towers have been knocked out in a number of areas. The National Weather Service said Hurricane Dora, which was passing about 500 miles to the south, safely to the south, was partly to blame for wind gusts above 60 miles per hour that knocked out power, rattled homes, and crucially here, grounded firefighting helicopters. It was just too windy for them to take off early to fight the blazes before they were able to spread.
Yeah, and the worst damage so far of the fires that have broken out across the Big Island and Maui does appear to be in Maui. And, you know, it's really shocking and surprising because this is not really normal for Hawaii and for Maui to have this level of wildfire, this intensity of mm-hmm. wildfire. And part of that is due, at least according to the National Weather Service and the U.S. Drought Monitor, Maui has been mired in months of drought, which has primed primed the islands for fire risks. And more than a third of Maui County is under at least moderate drought. And so these abnormally dry conditions have developed rapidly and have persisted, and they've had below normal precipitation for, and this is during what is typically a dry time of year. And those weather patterns from Hurricane Dora have helped boost those winds that they normally get. And, you know, what the sad part is that there is nearly zero rainfall in the forecast for most locations, according to the National Weather Service. And there's one other interesting tidbit regarding climate change in this, that the Washington Post reports that fires on the Hawaiian Islands were previously sparked by volcano eruptions and dry lightning strikes, but they've become more common. Fires have become more common over the past century as humans have introduced more non-native, fire-prone grasses and shrubs, which provide, of course, more sources for ignition. Yep. So non-native grasslands and shrubs that cover almost a quarter of Hawaii's total land area, according to a wildfire management group. And they're becoming even more flammable as climate change is bringing warmer and drier conditions.
The main airport in Maui is sheltering some 2,000 travelers whose flights were canceled or who recently arrived on the island, according to officials. The island of Oahu, where Honolulu is located, is dealing with power outages and downed lines. Officials are preparing the Hawaii Convention Center in Honolulu to take in thousands of displaced tourists and locals there. So sending our best to our friends, our listeners out at KAKU, hoping you guys are okay and still on the air out there. And by the way, and staying safe. Please feel free to drop us some email if your computers are working, if your internet is up, if you are safe.
Reach out and let us know you're doing okay.
Via that would be bradcast@bradblog.com. We'd love to hear from you one way or another, how things are going and that you are okay. All right, on to some brighter news, I think. Definitely brighter news, at least for democracy. If not for Hawaii this afternoon. Brighter news that I had hoped we would start the show with today until that late breaking news. Quote, these unnecessary off-cycle elections aren't good for taxpayers, election officials, or the civic health of our state. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, said in late 2022 as he led the fight at the time in the state to ban low turnout August special elections that cost taxpayers more than LaRose, as the state's chief election officials, thought that they were worth to his constituents. Quote, it's time for them to go, said LaRose. He was successful in his advocacy at the time, convincing Republican lawmakers in the gerrymandered state house to do away with those August elections for good. And then, really, just weeks later, as LaRose was becoming a Republican challenger to Ohio's Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown in next year's election, coincidentally enough, LaRose became the state's highest profile advocate for a special election in August that he'd hoped would preempt a November constitutional ballot initiative in the Buckeye State that, if adopted by a majority of voters, would codify reproductive freedoms for all. Yes, abortion rights into the state constitution. Issue one would change the percentage of voters needed to adopt a constitutional amendment from a simple majority of 50% plus one, as had been the case for more than 100 years in the state, to a supermajority of 60% needed for passage. That's the special election in August that LaRose decided he was in favor of. As it turns out, the November ballot measure to codify abortion rights, well, that was polling at about 58%. So that 60% number for the August election for what they were calling for in changing the Constitution, that was no accident for the hypocritical, ambitious, deceptive, dishonest Secretary of State in Ohio and his hypocritical, authoritarian, deceptive, dishonest Republican colleagues in the state. And the best thing for LaRose and friends was that in order to change the Constitution to require 60% approval for all future constitutional amendments, they would only need 50% plus one to pass their cynical, authoritarian, anti-democracy ballot measure through the August special election that all of them had just voted to ban in the state. LaRose claimed for months that issue one, the only thing on the statewide ballot on the August 8th special election, which would cost Ohio taxpayers at least $20 million, he would claim that had nothing at all to do with abortion. Quote, "That's not what this kind of change should ever be about," the secretary said last November. According to a News 5 in Cleveland report in June, quote, "Every single time LaRose had been asked if issue one was related to abortion, he denied it." That was, at least, until Frank LaRose was caught at a GOP fundraiser telling supporters, quote, "It's 100% about keeping a, quote, radical pro-abortion amendment out of our Constitution." His admission quickly made its way into an ad opposing LaRose's initiative.
"Admitting issue one is 100% about abortion.
And so, yes, it's about abortion.
Corrupt politicians and special interests have called a special election this August to rewrite Ohio's Constitution to end majority rule.
Yes, it's about abortion.
They're trying to rig the rules to lock in Ohio's extreme abortion ban and stop efforts to restore our rights.
It's about abortion.
To protect our rights and our freedom to decide, vote no on issue one in August."
So in case you are still wondering why I continue to tell you that the Republican Party is now an anti-democracy and pro-autocracy party, well, there you go. A pretty picture-perfect example. And while the GOP has hoaxed Buckeye Staters into falling for a whole lot of BS in recent years, enough to turn much of that state red in recent presidential elections, voting to take away their own rights, their own rights of self-governance, was apparently just a bridge too far, even in Ohio. You know how I often argued in recent years that democracy is on the ballot? Well, in Ohio, on Tuesday, it quite literally was on the ballot. And the good news? Democracy won again. Also on the ballot, rights and freedoms, in this case, abortion rights, which apparently are wildly popular, even in some of the nation's deepest red states. We will be speaking with a guest momentarily from one of them. Frank LaRose, on his LaRose for Senate stationery, put out a statement after losing on Tuesday, hoping to assuage his base, describing the loss as, quote, "Only one battle in a long war," I guess a war against democracy, citing the, quote, "radical activists," unquote. Apparently there are millions of them in Ohio. Who knew? The radical activists who opposed issue one. Unfortunately, LaRose whined, quote, "We were dramatically outspent by dark money billionaires." And you know how Republicans hate dark money billionaires. Dark money billionaires from California to New York. Well, in fact, as the American Prospect's Robert Kuttner reports, citing Ballotpedia today, that of the roughly $32 million spent on the initiative by both sides, about 80% was from out-of-state sources, but that was divided about equally between both of the sides on this issue, and the biggest single donor, biggest single donation was $4 million from right-winger Richard Uihlein. Other than that, yeah, they were just totally, dramatically outspent by dark money billionaires. Total turnout for the one single issue on Tuesday's ballot in Ohio will be about 3.1 million once all the votes are tallied, according to data researcher Tom Bonnier of Target Smart. Last year's midterm primary elections with competitive races for both U.S. Senate and governor was about half that number.
So there was higher turnout on Tuesday to preserve democracy and rights than there were for the midterm elections.
For the midterm primary elections.
Okay.
Yes,
thank
but
you.
It was pretty close to the midterm elections as well, to be frank. As Politico notes, Ohioans on Tuesday soundly defeated a proposal that would have made it more difficult to alter the state's constitution. The move, they say, is a lightning rod moment for abortion rights, even if the issue was not directly on the ballot. Voters overwhelmingly rejected issue one, 57-43%. As of the latest unconfirmed tallies today, 57-43 against an amendment that would have raised the threshold to pass a constitutional amendment from a simple majority to 60%. The measure's defeat now gives abortion rights supporters a clearer path to victory in their own constitutional amendment, protecting reproductive freedoms on this November's ballot. Opponents of Issue 1 view the victory as the first battle on abortion in the coming election cycle next year, when the issue will almost certainly be a factor in competitive Senate and House races that could help determine who controls Congress. But opponents also frame their victory as one that protects the power of the simple majority. You know, democracy. Democracy matters everywhere, said Ohio Democratic Party Chair Liz Walters, pointing to Arkansas and South Dakota, where voters similarly rejected efforts to implement a supermajority requirement for ballot initiatives. The election saw record turnout for what's typically a sleepy August election date, according to AP. Democrats described the victory in Ohio, a one-time battleground state that has shifted markedly to the right, as a, quote, major warning sign for the GOP. Quote, Republicans' deeply unpopular war on women's rights will cost them district after district, and we will remind voters of their toxic anti-abortion agenda every day until November, said Aiden Johnson, a spokesperson for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or DCCC. Support for Issue 1 on Tuesday fell far, far short of Donald Trump's performance during the 2020 election in nearly every county in the state. Democratic Mayor Andrew Ginther of Columbus, Ohio, shout out to our peeps at our affiliate WGRN in Columbus, said that he was proud of his state last night.
Proud of Ohio, proud of Ohioans who believe in majority rule and one person, one vote. It's worked well for this state for 111 years, and the people came out and sent a very strong message to an extremist supermajority in the legislature that they believe in fairness. They believe in freedom, and they believe in the power to hold them accountable.
Wow, they believe in freedom and fairness.
And the power of democracy.
The power of democracy to hold officials accountable. Ohio's GOP-led state government in 2019 approved a ban on abortion after cardiac activity is detected around 6 weeks. That is, of course, before many women know that they are even pregnant. After the ban briefly went into effect, a state court put the ban on hold while a challenge alleging it violates the state constitution plays out. Adoption of November's ballot initiative, however, would clarify that currently outstanding legal question in the state. During the time that the ban was in place in Ohio, an Indiana doctor came forward to say that she had performed an abortion on a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio who could not legally have the procedure in her own home state. The account became a national flashpoint in the debate over abortion rights and underscored the stakes in Ohio, one of about half of U.S. states where citizens may bypass the state legislature, in this case, the wildly and unlawfully gerrymandered state legislature, in order to put ballot questions directly to voters. So, of course, Republicans had to make that harder. The 60% threshold Republicans attempted but failed to institute on Tuesday, that number was no accident. It was not a random number. Since Roe v. Wade was overturned last year, six states have had elections regarding reproductive rights. In every election, including in you know, usually deep red states like Kansas, voters have supported abortion rights by big numbers, but numbers that are just below 60%. In Kansas, 59% voted to preserve abortion rights protections. In Michigan, 57% favored an amendment that put protections in the state constitution. And last year, about 59% of Ohio voters said that abortion should be legal, according to an AP poll. Opponents of the abortion question ran ads that lied to voters by suggesting the measure would somehow strip parents of their ability to make decisions about their child's health care or to even be notified about it, that somehow children, little girls in that ad would be running off and having sex changes without having to tell mom and dad first.
In other words, the Republicans and those who supported this anti-democratic issue one had to go out of their way to lie and deceive voters in order to trick them into voting for it.
Didn't work.
Yeah, they caught on. Work. Voters are too smart for you guys in Ohio.
The main anti-choice groups that were supporting issue one, the main group that was supporting was a group called a so-called Protect Women Ohio. Their campaign called the ballot measure a, quote, dangerous anti-parent amendment. That, of course, hoping to cash in on the so-called parents' rights culture war movement that Republicans have been leaning on since it appeared to be to help propel Virginia's Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin to victory, 2 years ago now, I think, in one of the few bright electoral spots for the GOP in recent years. And since everything else they are in favor of happens to be wildly unpopular, let's go with the parents' rights thing. Maybe we can hoax voters with that. Legal experts, however, have said there is no language in the Ohio Issue 1 amendment supporting the ad's claims, and voters apparently did not fall for them. While the November question pertains strictly to Ohio, access to abortion there is pivotal to access across the Midwest, according to Allison Dreyeth, the director of strategic partnership for the Midwest Access Coalition. 9 Midwestern states, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Ohio, Nebraska, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin are considered restrictive, very restrictive, or most restrictive of abortion rights by the Guttmacher Institute, a research and policy organization that supports access, legal access to abortion. Dreyeth said, quote, Ohio in particular has always been a destination for the states around it. If we don't protect abortion access in Ohio, the options just continue to shrink for people seeking care in the Midwest. Sri Thakalapati, the executive director of a Cleveland-based nonprofit abortion clinic, said the effect of the Ohio vote will reverberate throughout the country. For the majority who do want abortion access in their states but are seeing it threatened, the results in November could give them hope that the democratic process may give them relief, she said. Kimberly Inez McGuire, the executive director of Unite for Reproductive and Gender Equity, or URGE, which focuses on young people of color under 30, says the results of elections involving reproductive rights show that support does not just come from Democrats or in cities and states that are considered liberal bastions. There was this idea, she said, that we couldn't win on abortion in red states. And that idea has really been smashed now, she said. So too, is the mythology that people in the South and Midwest won't support abortion rights. She said, I think 2024 is going to be huge. And I think in many ways, Ohio is a proving ground and early fight in the lead up to 2024. That, by the way, 2024 is when Ohio's Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, the lead brainchild and hypocrite behind Tuesday's expensive and dramatically failed ballot initiative, 2024 is when Frank LaRose hopes to be on the ballot facing the popular incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown for the U.S. Senate. We will see if Ohio voters will remember all of this by then. So good news in Ohio, but what does Ohio's fight actually mean to the rest of the country today, including those far-right states in the deep South like Alabama, where a full ban on reproductive rights has been in place since Roe was overturned last year? Well, Tuesday's victory in Ohio may just be giving fans of freedom in Alabama some hope as well. Let's take a quick break, and we will be joined by Robin Marty of the West Alabama Women's Center. She's also author of two books on life after Roe v. Wade. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
And I'll rise like the day.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Ohio voters rose up in huge numbers during early voting and on Tuesday for the special election in Ohio to vote against the cynical, hypocritical issue one placed on the ballot that would have made it harder for citizens to change Ohio's constitution by requiring 60% to adopt new constitutional amendments instead of a simple majority, as has been the case for about, more than 110 years. The amendment on the ballot on Tuesday, placed there by Republicans just months ago and just weeks after they had banned August special elections, would have blocked the more than 110-year practice of a simple majority to change the state constitution, and it was meant in no uncertain terms to make passage of a November amendment to write protections for reproductive freedoms into the Buckeye State Constitution much more difficult, if not impossible, to pass. But the anti-democracy measure pushed by Republicans failed, and it failed bigly on Tuesday with no votes outnumbering yes votes by 13 points, 57-43, according to the latest unconfirmed results. Abortion rights advocates still need to win the abortion constitutional amendment in Ohio in November, noted TPM's Josh Marshall after the victory was called very shortly after polls closed by the AP. But he writes, it seems highly likely they will succeed. Ohio thus joins Kansas and Kentucky in rejecting restrictions on abortion rights in their respective state constitutions. Last year, voters in Michigan enshrined abortion rights in their state constitution, and Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, leveraged the issue to win unified control of the state in Democratic hands for the first time in decades. In all but the very most so-called conservative states, the only path forward for abortion restrictionists, he argues, is simply keep the issue off the ballot. Joining us now is someone who knows a little something about those most so-called conservative states. This one in the South, in Alabama, and what all of this means going forward is Robin Marty, the operations director for the West Alabama Women's Center, which provides judgment-free reproductive health services in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, of all places. She's also the author of 2019's prescient The New Handbook for a Post-Roe America and The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Right's Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. Robin Marty, welcome to the Bradcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Brad.
Delighted to have you here today on this, I think, a good news day for sure. First, just a top line, of course, your response to what happened on Tuesday in Ohio.
Of course, I'm very excited about it. I'm not surprised, though. This is yet another in a series of wins for abortion rights when it is put up to a statewide vote. The ones that you mentioned, obviously, but also we have the case in Wisconsin where the Supreme Court judge that was having their election ran on the idea of mm-hmm. the fact that they would try to return abortion rights to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and that was a sweep. We obviously had Kansas. We had all of these other different ways that we've seen that abortion rights are extraordinarily popular. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, abortion rights have always been extraordinarily popular. We have had these statewide referendums before in the past. In Colorado, we saw personhood come up four different times, and every single time, personhood was voted down by a majority, usually 60%. Again, we saw almost 60% in Ohio. In Mississippi, of all places, in 2011, personhood was put up for an election, and that also went down by 60%. Mm-hmm. So we know that there is a very solid, regardless of what state you go to, at least 60% majority that believes that people should have the right to control their own bodies. And that is why we're seeing that it's not even just the idea of abortion being up for a debate and for a vote, but why we are seeing these changes in how democracy itself and how elections themselves are happening in these states that are trying to hold on to this minority rule. That's why it was about, can we change the state constitution to 60% mm-hmm. in order to change an amendment? That's why we saw Mississippi now no longer has ballot initiatives at all. And when they were debating whether ballot initiatives can be reintroduced after the Supreme Court was fighting about the marijuana legality initiative that happened. Mm-hmm. The Republicans said, we'd be willing to let you have initiatives again, just as long as you don't do it about abortion. and in Alabama, we have personhood. It's the only state where personhood ever has passed Amendment 2. And that's it, the way that our setup works, we would not be able to initiate a ballot initiative because it would have to go through the legislature first, and the legislature would have to pass an agreement to then allow us to have that vote. They were willing to do that when they thought that they could get personhood, which honestly they could get because nobody really understood what that meant and what that impact would be in real life. Now Alabama is showing polling that says that 60% of people there do not believe that abortion should be illegal. So we know that this is the right stance.
Where I know in, I think it was 2019, Alabama passed a law banning nearly all abortions in the state, a so-called heartbeat law. That was before the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade's 50 years of protections. You know, I know in Ohio, they instituted a six-week ban in 2019. That law was blocked because of Roe v. Wade was still in place at the time. And the law in Ohio was then later blocked again. But what is the status of Alabama's abortion law at this time? Is it that 2019 law that was passed, or have they had to pass something else since the adoption of, since Roe was overturned in the Dobbs decision?
Right. So it actually was not a six-week ban. Alabama in 2019 was the first state to pass a total and complete abortion ban. Mm. And it had no exceptions for any sort of sexual assault, no exceptions for if a person has a medically indicated needed abortion. There was no exceptions whatsoever. And when that passed in 2019, that passed through a legislature that stated directly that all they wanted to do was force something up to the Supreme Court, a completely clean bill, so that they could overturn Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And they swore at that time, as the Democrats were trying to put in some sort of exceptions for sexual assault for these very, very minimal cases, they said, you know, we'll come back and we'll revisit that afterward. Right now, we're just trying to get this clean to the Supreme Court for that case. And unsurprisingly, they did not ever fix that. They did not change it. And in fact, when abortion became illegal, the literal moment that it became illegal in our state, not only did we have to stop every bit of abortion care that we were doing at that moment in the clinic, but our attorney general made statements saying that, in his opinion, he believed that to provide a person with information about how they can access legal abortion care somewhere else would, in fact, constitute a criminal conspiracy.
Oh, man.
And so that people could be arrested over that. As such, our clinic is one of the places where we have not provided this information to patients who come in. We are able to do every other sort of health care. We do prenatal care, free pregnancy confirmations, STI testing and treatment. We cannot tell a person who is pregnant where they can find a legal abortion. And that's devastating down here in the South, because all of the states have different restrictions or no abortion whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And the gestational ages change and vary so much that it's very difficult for a patient to try to navigate on their own where they need to go in order to get care based on how pregnant they are. And so that's why on July 31st, we actually filed a lawsuit with the ACLU and the other former provider in our state as well. And we have filed a lawsuit to request that the attorney general and all DAs be enjoined from arresting us or threatening prosecution should we provide legal medical information.
I just have to sort of underscore that, because it's so extraordinary, especially as, you know, we're in the middle of all of these fights with Donald Trump's indictment. And we're hearing, over and over again from the right that the left, the Democrats, they want to ban free speech. You're saying that actual medical professionals in Alabama are disallowed from even telling a woman where she could go, what state, where this procedure could be available? Even giving that information is unlawful in the state of Alabama?
Based on the statements that the attorney general has made, yes, that is what we believe. And as such, we have been unable to provide that information.
And what is the penalty if you commit the terrible crime of telling someone where abortions might still be legal?
So it would be considered a criminal conspiracy, which is a felony. The current actual law for providing an abortion or helping someone obtain an abortion is up to 99 years in jail. And so I believe that as a criminal co-conspirator, it can be as much as a third of what the sentence is for a person that actually does the event itself. So I believe that we're looking at like 30 years in jail.
If I showed up outside the West Alabama Women's Center with a pamphlet, a piece of paper, print out something and say, hey, you can go here and here and here and call this number to get medical care, would I be violating the law in Alabama?
I'm not going to give you legal advice or in any way, shape, or form answer that, because this is based on what the attorney general has stated. Mm-hmm. We know that there is that threat there for prosecution.
Wow. That's just extraordinary. And talk about chilling free speech. The fact that you're not even comfortable responding to that question says a great deal, Robin Marty. So with all of that in mind, you know, we've seen states like Michigan pass amendments, Ohio, hopefully this November will pass a freedom amendment. How does one fight for, as you write about in your two books, how does one fight for these rights in a solid red so-called state in the Deep South?
Well, I'm excited to say that a number of different states, even in the Deep South, are looking at, or conservative states in general, are looking at ballot initiatives. I can tell you that Florida is currently looking at one. I believe that they are in the process. And frankly, if a person is going to support a red state in this sort of effort, Florida is definitely where they need to go. Florida is, at this point, the only accessible place for abortion for people who are in the Gulf area. So Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, all of those states have no legal abortion whatsoever. Georgia has legal abortion only up to 6 weeks, so about 2 weeks after a missed period. Mm-hmm. Florida is at this point able to have abortion to 15 weeks. And now, right now, I'm like, okay, am I allowed to say
yeah,
this?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, are you allowed to tell me this?
I am talking to a reporter.
Uh-huh,
I am
thank
talking
you.
To the media, and I am providing you with publicly available information.
Thank
and
you.
As far as I know, you are not pregnant, so I think I should be okay.
Right.
And so Florida is going to be the place that this fight is going to happen, because at this point, Florida did pass a 6-week abortion ban. So again, that is 2 weeks after a missed period. And it has been held up by the state Supreme Court, which is expected to put down its ruling at any moment. But I do want to make it clear that even in Florida, there is not a lot of abortion access. Most of the access is further down in the peninsula, which makes sense, because that's where the most heavily populated areas are. But for my people, the people who are in Mississippi, who are in Alabama, you have to get all the way over to Tallahassee, which is halfway through the panhandle, in order to be able to actually get to a clinic. So even in that case, it's still extraordinarily difficult for people. In our area, the closest place where a person is likely to be able to get a first trimester abortion is South Carolina. And now they don't have North Carolina anymore, because that just got reduced. So we're sending, we would be sending people all the way up to DC or to Illinois. That's the only place that people can be absolutely positive that they can get in and get abortions.
So it sounds like the answer, at least for now, at least in states like Alabama, is to hope for these court battles to be won, I guess, in other states. You guys, like you said, you can't get a constitutional amendment on the ballot, a ballot initiative. By the way, would a ballot initiative pass to protect?
I think so, yes.
In Alabama.
Very much.
Yeah.
I do firmly believe that based on the polling that we already have. But again, you have to get down to the idea of who is allowed to vote, which is a really important question in Alabama.
Yes.
Alabama is one of the few states that has no early voting. It has no absentee ballots. They actually tried to pass a law this year that says that it's illegal to help someone with an absentee ballot. Yep. The only cases that you can file one is if you are in a hospital or if you are an election worker. A person who is has had a felony never gets their voting rights back, regardless of whether they served their time, what it was for, anything like that. And I want people to know that's really important, because when we are looking at all of the new bills that were introduced, like when we compare now to before Roe was ever decided in the first place in the 70s, the punishments are so very different. And one of the things that is very definite about what happens now is when you looked at things like aiding and abetting laws, or this idea of criminal conspiracy, all of these laws have huge punishments for the person who is providing an abortion. But if you help somebody get an abortion, that is a felony. And that is a felony in states where if you are charged with a felony, you will never vote again. That is purposeful.
Yep.
That is meant to make sure that the people that do not agree with them are not able to exercise their right to vote.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's meant to send a very chilling message, by the way, as was what happened in Ohio there. Now the Republicans there lied about it. They said, oh, this isn't about abortion. Then the Secretary of State there was caught admitting, yeah, it's 100% about abortion. But it's very much meant to frighten people, to chill free speech. And yet it seems it's potent in state after state at the ballot box. Now, there was a time and now sort of an infamous New York Times headline, as I recall, back before the 2022 midterms, which argued that, you know, in the months after the Dobbs ruling last year, the issue had sort of lost its potency. Democrats were no longer leaning on it in the midterm elections. I don't know if the Times, New York Times, was wrong, if Democrats were wrong, but it sounds like you're suggesting the so-called potency of this issue for voters. Is it growing? Is it ebbing? Will it still be have the same sort of power a year from now once we get to the 2024 presidential election? And what, if any, effect will that have in a state like Alabama?
Well, I do very much think that this is actually becoming a bigger issue as time passes. And one of the reasons is because as this continues, first of all, we're losing more states. Mm-hmm. So more states have had abortion access the moment that Dobbs happened that have had it taken away from them. North Carolina has had theirs greatly reduced. Obviously, Wisconsin lost theirs. Like, a number of states have had more restrictions put on them. So that impact is starting to be felt. But also the impact of people who are trying to access abortion now that clinics are beginning to close up around the country, that is pushing it further away for the people who are in blue states that are trying to access it as well. So blue state people are also being impacted by these laws, even though their states may be improving access. We know that now everybody is engaged because of the potential ban on medication abortion, which is still kind of sitting out there somewhere in the Fifth Circuit, and who knows what's going to happen with that. And also, we are seeing more and more now, we are just getting the first hint of what sort of impact it's having on people who are forced to give birth. We do know that in Texas, I believe there were 10,000 births that they do not believe would have happened if Texas had not had illegal abortion. And remember, Texas made abortion illegal in September, so 9 months before Dobbs even happened, because they had their own 6-week ban. So Texas is kind of the bellwether, as always, as to what it's going to look like. I believe that a lot of these new numbers are really going to start to hit right before the election, and that is going to be vitally important. What I am hoping is that we can do across the nation what happened in states like Michigan, what happened in Minnesota, where the entirety of the ruling body was taken over by Democrats that believed that they could then make expansive abortion rights. Because in a lot of ways, that may be the only thing that will ever save states like Alabama and Mississippi, is the idea that the federal government will make this legal to an aspect and to a point where that will require every state to have an abortion provider. What I fear is that as you look at Alabama's utter unwillingness to follow any sort of federal rule, that it's still not going to work. You saw when the Voting Rights Act, our congressional map came back and they said, make two districts. And Alabama Republicans said, I'm not going to do it. And middle fingered this in the courts and gave it right back. That's the kind of stuff that happens here. And so I do have a fear that if we ever get to a point where we have federal abortion laws and federal abortion access, that Alabama is just going to say no. And I don't know what's going to happen then. But the other side of this is also that if we get federal abortion access, all of our clinics are gone. We're still here, but Mississippi, nobody has left. Louisiana, nobody has left. Texas, nobody has left. So all of those states are going to have to start from scratch. And they're going to once again be fighting these really restrictive Republican city councils, state legislatures, all of the things that created trap laws in the first place that made it impossible for them to be able to open more clinics even before abortion was made illegal. And so, like, we will be set to go right back into work the moment that there's a federal abortion law, but that's not going to be the case for many other states.
And, you know, I want to remind people, because, you know, people tend to think of states like Alabama, Mississippi, oh, they're so deep red, they would, you know, never come around, even if this was opened up to all the voters, if the voters were allowed to vote. You know, it was not all that long ago that Don Siegelman, a friend of this show, he was on with us just a few weeks ago regarding Alabama giving the middle finger to the Supreme Court. You know, Don Siegelman, a Democrat who held statewide, he was, I think, the only person in Alabama history to hold all of the statewide offices at various times throughout his career. He was governor not that long ago. Things can change. Robin, Marty, how do the fights around the country right now, how do they match up to your arguments in your two books on, you know, how to fight in a post-Roe America, which was, I think, published in 2019. So a couple of years before that was actually the case. Are you seeing now the fights that you predicted? Is there something that we can do better? You know, codifying Roe's protections into federal law? And would that even be enough? Or are there other measures that we should be taking?
Well, codifying Roe is not going to be enough, because we knew even before Dobbs happened that there were a lot of people who were not able to access abortion, either because of financial reasons, because of logistical reasons. And honestly, those are the people right now who are even more left behind because of the fact that there are people out here who there's no amount of money that you can give them that would allow them to be able to leave the state for an abortion. They are undocumented, or they have too many children. All of these other things are happening. Mm-hmm. You can only solve so much with money. So one of the things that I tell people is that as we head forward and as we look at abortion as a human right rather than just a constitutional right, mm-hmm. we need to recognize that every person who is capable of becoming pregnant, regardless of how rich they are, how young they are, how healthy they are, where they live, what care they have access to, every person has the potential to die in childbirth. And that is just a simple fact. Every person can die in childbirth. I mean, Serena Williams, for God's sake. Mm. Anyone can die. And if we use that as our basis, then it makes complete and utter sense to say that no person should be forced to potentially lose their life giving birth because somebody else thinks that they should have to stay pregnant. When we work from that and we use that angle, then that is where we can start to make the stances of any person should be able to access medication in their own home. No person should have to travel if they do not wish to in order to access an abortion. Yeah. Every person should be able to go into a hospital if they believe that they are having a complication or if something is going wrong, and not worry about being turned into the police or worried about their family or someone who supports them being arrested. These are all basic rights that people should have, and they are not constitutional rights. They are the right of being human. Mm. You should have access to save your own life, and nobody, yourself or anyone who helps you, should be punished for helping you do that.
You know, all of those, obviously, critical fights, and yet echoing in my mind is the fact that you've had to go to court to simply tell your patients where they can get medical care. Just freedom of speech. That's how bad it has gotten. Robin Marty, Operations Director for the West Alabama Women's Center, author of the 2019 books, The New Handbook for Post-Roe America and The End of Roe v. Wade. Robin, I really hope you'll stay in touch with us as your fight goes forward down there in Alabama with the ACLU filing that suit, because it all just kind of blows me away. But boy, am I happy the folks down there in Alabama have you fighting for them. Thank you, Robin. You can find her and follow her at Robin Marty on the site formerly known as Twitter. Robin, thank you so much again for joining us once again at very short notice today.
Of course, anytime, Brad.
Thank you. She is delightful.
Indeed, and quite a force of nature.
She is delightful and heroic.
Yes,
and brave. You know, all of the women and the men who are working at these clinics, all across the country, frankly, you know, given the violence we have seen against those folks over the years. But, mm-hmm. you know, now at this time in this country, in this political atmosphere, in a state like Alabama, where they are fighting to even, you know, inform patients.
Oh, I know.
It's about their rights and where they can, you know, go to get health care.
I mean, criminalizing speech, you know, medical health care speech, and then, you know, also pushing to forced birth. I mean, that, hey, Alabama, you guys are in trouble there. Well, you in danger, girl.
Yeah.
And I just think it's also just mind blowing. One of the things that Robin said, which was the right of being human, the mm-hmm. right to save your own life and for others to help you save your own life, still blows my mind that is where we are in 2023.
It is absolutely mind-boggling, and I had hoped, if I had time, and I don't think that I do here now, but there have been some favorable court rulings in response to some of the things that she was talking about. A judge in Texas has decided that their abortion ban is too restrictive for women with pregnancy complications because doctors down there are afraid to even to treat them when these women come in and need to have abortions to save their life. Again, Robin had mentioned 99-year penalty. That's what they're facing down in Texas. That's
right.
What doctors are facing if they simply give medical care.
Life-saving medical care.
And remember, this is, you know, the people opposing this are the same Republicans who back in 2010 were, you know, just furious about Obamacare, claiming that it was going to be big government becoming coming between doctors and their patients. They're out there pushing this crap now. The Republicans who are out there pretending to be furious that they took away Donald Trump's free speech rights, which they didn't. His latest indictment has nothing to do with his free speech rights. It's not about what he said. It is about what he did. But if they are so furious about freedom of speech, and yet they're sitting around supporting this crap that is going on down in places like Alabama and elsewhere and Texas.
I know. And it just it's also still mind blowing. I guess I retain the capacity to have my mind blown that Republicans pretend to be the party of small government. And I guess that means really the party of big government in your doctor's office, in your bedroom, in your schools, telling you what you can and cannot say.
And, you know, those lifetime voting bans that Robin was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is one state in the South where that may be about to get knocked down by one of the most so-called conservative courts in the nation. That would be Mississippi, where we also had some surprisingly good news from the courts. Another story I don't have time for, but we will try to get to it in another thrilling edition of the broadcast.
Yes, but first, good job, Ohio. You guys did it. Good work.
Good job, Ohio, and good luck to our friends up in or out in Maui.
Yes.
Fighting those deadly fires out there. Okay. That was a big show. I got to get out my thanks once again to our guest, Robin Marty of the West Alabama Women's Center, to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always an honor. It is always appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free. Thanks to those of you who support our work at brandblog.com/donate, where you can make a donation of any amount you like, one-time or automated subscription each month, one and done, as they say, all of which are greatly appreciated and very much needed right now. So thank you in advance. brandblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, especially if you're out there in Maui. I'd love to hear that you're okay or not. bradcast@bradblog.com, and follow me on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and X-Twitters. At the Brad Blog. There you go. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.